Hi, it's Charlie Connolly here. I write every week in the New European on books and literature and great European lives. If you'd like to enjoy more from the New European, you can join us by subscribing at theneweuropean.co.uk/subscribe. That's theneweuropean.co.uk/subscribe. Great European Lives. From the New European. Jean-Pierre Blanchard, 4th of July 1753 to the 7th of March 1809. The morning of January the 7th, 1785, dawned bright and clear, and the coast of France was clearly visible across the Channel from the castle above Dover. The Channel had always made England a fortress. 21 miles across even at its narrowest point, not to mention a notoriously unpleasant sea crossing, it lent a level of security that had ensured only two successful major military invasions in the previous 1700 years, first by the Romans, then the Normans. That perception was about to change. Jean-Pierre Blanchard emerged from his quarters and looked up at the flags. He'd been waiting for the wind to turn for days, and was delighted to see that during the night it had stopped blowing from the east and was now coming from the northwest, the perfect direction for his planned voyage. He roused his co-pilot, an American physician, Dr. John Jeffries, and the pair set about inflating the balloon for a flight that, if successful, would make Blanchard and Jeffries the first people to cross the Channel by air. Blanchard's plan was an incredibly dangerous one. It was only just over a year since Jean-François Pilâtre de Rozier had made the first ever manned flight in a heavier-than-air vehicle, a gentle 25-minute, 5-mile drift in a balloon across Paris. The Channel presented a flight of at least 21 miles, wind-dependent, with nowhere in between to land. There was a significant risk of ditching in the sea, and only a minimal chance of rescue, not to mention the wind changing and carrying the aircraft out into the North Sea. It's not even as if Blanchard was an experienced balloonist. Before that day, he'd only made 5 ascents. But what he lacked in experience, he more than made up for with ambition and a gigantic ego. Blanchard had always felt destined for great things. He'd developed a keen interest in physics and engineering at a young age in his hometown of Rouen. And despite relatively humble origins, his father was a joiner, developed an ambition to become an inventor whose innovations would see his name spoken all around the world. At 16, he produced a velocipede, an early form of bicycle that created enough of a stir to have investors willing to support future projects. By 1782, Blanchard had turned his attention to flying machines. His vaisseau volant, a wooden contraption with 4 flappable wings operated by a lever, proved to be a humiliating failure, to the extent that satirical pamphlets were produced in Paris, which sold by the cartload. The success of the Montgolfier brothers' prototype hot air balloons focused his attention in that direction instead, and on the 2nd of March 1784, at the Champ de Mars in Paris, where the Eiffel Tower stands today, Blanchard unveiled a 26-foot-high, silk-covered green and yellow balloon, with a boat-shaped gondola suspended beneath, hoping an impressive demonstration might attract investment to fund further and more ambitious projects. The city came to a standstill. Roads were closed, and a huge crowd had assembled by the time the balloon was fully inflated. Just as Blanchard was about to launch, a student named Dupont, a classmate of Napoleon Bonaparte as it happened, hopped into the gondola and announced that he was coming too. When Blanchard demurred, Dupont produced a sword and set about slashing at the balloon and its ropes, causing serious damage and wounding Blanchard in the hand. Despite the damage and his injury, Blanchard not only managed to ascend, but stayed in the air for an impressive 2 hours. But when this display and a further demonstration at Rouen failed to attract the kind of extra cash he was after, Blanchard folded up his balloon and headed for London, where he presented himself as the world's finest aeronaut, reeled off a number of startling balloon accomplishments in France, nearly all of which he'd made up, and announced his intention to cross the Channel by air. His sales patter was enough to attract the interest and cash of Jeffreys, who offered to cover the costs of the attempt as long as he could come too. The Frenchman agreed reluctantly, but, seeking the glory entirely for himself, put almost as much work into keeping Jeffreys out of the gondola as he did in preparing for the crossing. Blanchard drew up a contract with a clause requiring Jeffreys to jump out during the flight if it was necessary to save the balloon. Once they'd reached their base at Dover Castle, Blanchard sent Jeffreys on an errand, bolted the castle gates, and refused to let him back in. He only relented when Jeffreys returned with soldiers from the militia. Even on the day of the flight, once the balloon was inflated and they had loaded their equipment into the gondola, including a pair of cork life jackets, promotional pamphlets Blanchard planned to throw out over France, 30 pounds of ballast, and Jeffreys' meteorological instruments, the two men stepped into the gondola, Blanchard loosened a couple of mooring ropes, and frowned. Normally the balloon would be straining to rise at this point, he said, but they were clearly too heavy. He was very sorry, but the doctor's weight was clearly the difference between the success and failure of the expedition. Jeffreys would just have to let Blanchard go alone. The doctor, meanwhile, had already noticed his colleague was filling his clothes a little more snugly than usual. He first asked, then insisted that the Frenchman open his coat, upon which it became clear that Blanchard had fashioned himself a belt from which he had hung a series of lead weights. Despite Blanchard's chicanery, when the mooring ropes were released and the balloon began to ascend, both men were in the gondola and marvelling at the view. It was such a clear day that as they eased out over the sea, they could see as far as Canterbury Cathedral behind them. Halfway across, the balloon began to lose altitude. Out went the ballast, arresting the descent for a while, but the closer they drew to the French coast, the lower the balloon seemed to be sinking. Over the side went the pamphlets, their food supplies, the bottle of brandy they'd brought as a defence against the cold, even the cloth lining inside the gondola. Yet still they were heading straight for the chalk cliffs just outside Calais. Things became desperate enough for the two men to strip down to their underwear and jettison their clothes, then prepare for the most drastic action of all, to cut the gondola itself loose and hang from the ropes in an attempt to save themselves. Just as the situation appeared hopeless, the balloon suddenly started to rise. 2 hours after they had set out, as the men stared at the approaching cliffs, the aircraft lifted gracefully over them. Not only that, it carried them several miles inland before the balloon began to descend again, by which time the pair were, in Jeffreys' words, benumbed with cold. Eventually they were able to make a controlled crash landing in a forest near Guisnes, where the pair were found in a clearing huddling together for warmth. Unconventional it may have looked, not least with both men clad in just their underwear, but Blanchard and Jeffreys had just become the first humans to cross the Channel by air. They were escorted to Calais for some wild celebrations, and then to Paris for an audience with Louis XVI, who immediately awarded Blanchard a royal pension that set him up for life. Having achieved the fame he'd always craved, the Frenchman worked hard to maintain it, touring Europe giving demonstrations, chalking up the first recorded balloon flights in Belgium, the Netherlands, Germany and Poland, and in 1791 making a flight to mark the coronation of the King of Bohemia. 2 years later, Blanchard travelled to America and made that continent's first flight, from Philadelphia to Deptford, New Jersey, a journey witnessed by the President, George Washington, as well as future President Thomas Jefferson. Sometimes it appeared as if Blanchard was leading a charmed life. On one occasion, his balloon silk ruptured at altitude, but he happened to be carrying a prototype parachute that saved his life. But in February 1808, while giving a demonstration at The Hague, he suffered a heart attack in the gondola, staggered to its edge, and fell 50 feet to the ground. He died as a result of his injuries a year and a month later, at the age of 53. For all his bluster and colossal self-regard, Blanchard's crossing was a remarkable achievement, and a key moment in British relations with the rest of Europe. When his balloon sailed over the cliffs at Calais that sunny morning, the continent and its northwestern archipelago drew closer than ever before. Great European Lives is brought to you by The New European. It's written and presented by Charlie Connolly, and the series producer is Steve Anglesey.